then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 26th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I'd like to begin this week by thanking all of the comrades who attended our Midsummer Day get-together over here on the Olympic Peninsula. It was great to see some of you again. There was one family whom all of us missed, but we understand why they were unable to be there, and we'd like to extend our deepest sympathy and condolences to Comrade Kate on her recent loss. Right, I'm afraid this week I can't promise to stay within the comfort zone, because last week something happened which, after some consideration, I've decided to tell you guys about and to discuss openly. Now, the very first thing I want to say right up front is that I'm not completely convinced that this incident was legitimate, in that it may be an FBI entrapment hoax of some kind directed against me, in which case it would be advisable, I think, for me to kind of go on the attack, so to speak. Now, the Bureau now admits that they regularly carry out sting operations where some poor old Apu from the Quickie Mart is coaxed into a so-called jihadist cell that consists entirely of FBI agents and undercovers. Apu is provided with a suicide bomb jacket, or a so-called car bomb that contains nothing but inert material, and then he's arrested when he puts the jacket on and dragged away to a 30-year prison sentence. Now, what floors me about this is that the FBI admit in open court that they contrived the whole thing from beginning to end, and that the so-called crime would never have occurred if not for their involvement, nor would the poor brown bastard have even thought about it if FBI employees had not put the idea into his head. And these asshole judges back them up and still bury Apu alive. Well, if he wasn't an America-hating Muslim before, he is one now. And yes, in at least one case, they have done this to a native-born white American as well. Basically, there is, for all practical purposes, no politically motivated terrorism at all in this country, and so the FBI has to manufacture some every now and then to justify its incredibly bloated budget and keep their agents from being transferred to assignments where they might have to deal with real criminals. There is one school of thought that the whole Edgar Steele thing was fabricated by the Bureau's Spokane office, because now that Pastor Butler is dead and the Hayden Lake compound is gone, there was no need for all those agents up there, so the bean counters in the J. Edgar building were trying to slash the Spokane office's budget. All those agents would have had to move out of their nice suburban homes in that very white part of the country, with all the clean streets and good schools, and so the suits in Spokane figured they better pump up some more wicked, evil, racist terrorism fast. Dave Udseth was awash. All he gave them was that poor old guy from the Spokane Salvation Army mission, and Ed Steele was the only remaining high-value target remaining in their jurisdiction. Even that might have fallen apart in court if somebody from D.C. hadn't had a quiet word with the judge over drinks in the country club, or however it was done. So bingo, all of a sudden Edgar Steele gets first an alcoholic and then an indicted criminal facing prison himself as defense attorneys, and he's not allowed to call any defense witnesses to testify that the audio tapes were fabricated. Anyway, it is possible that this thing last week might be a cyber hoax on the part of the dictator's servants. Although, actually, I don't think so. I think this kid is real. He's just dumb as a bag of hammers. Now, to start with, many of you will have heard me refer in the past to people I call T-shirt youth. the young white boys with nothing but the t-shirts on their backs who dicked off in school and who did not get themselves a marketable skill and who now either live in their parents' basements or else they got kicked out of their parents' basements and they now kind of wander the earth in a daze. A lot of them have had enough racial awareness forced on them in these god-awful public schools to understand that they have no future in America, and they gravitate to the movement. Now, I've said before that if we did have some land and a bunkhouse and a place for them to flop, and if we could feed them a little rice and beans or something, and we'd loosen up on General Order Number 10 and let them swill beer in the bunkhouse, I could have hundreds of these guys up here in short order. Now, the problem is that would be putting the cart before the horse. We have to build the communities and the command and logistic structure first, like we should have started doing 50 years ago. Then we start bringing in and training and disciplining the foot soldiers. I know that is a message that you desperately, frantically do not want to hear. You want the fun part to begin now, now, now. I wish I could make that happen. Anyway, you guys know who I mean by T-shirt youth, right? I suspect most of you who aren't T-shirt youth yourself have some experience with them. I want to talk to you about one individual in particular. I will not give this young man's name or his location on the air. If the FBI wasn't behind this from the get-go and they're interested, they're going to have to call up the NSA and get hold of my email intercepts. There is this young man of about 17 or 18, if memory serves, who has been in intermittent email contact with me and possibly a few other party members for about a year. Now, my memory is really hazy here because he never figured in any major way. He was just a casual kid or self-identified as a kid who emailed me with questions and comments every now and then about race and general stuff. No one ever met him personally, and so I can't even swear for certain that he was who and what he claimed to be. Now, that's the one thing you always have to bear in mind. With the internet, you never know who you are talking to. Now, this kid, as I will continue to call him in the absence of any proof otherwise, kind of vanished for a while, although I didn't even notice he was gone. He just wasn't that important. And then last week, all of a sudden, I get a somewhat strange and stilted email from him to the effect that he wanted any tips or help I might give him on how to get to Seattle or Portland. He told me that he had no money, no ID, and he was homeless. I emailed him back and asked him how that had come about, and he in turn emailed me a second time, and this is where it gets dysfunctional. It seems that this young man had been done for shoplifting or some kind of stealing, and he had been in some kind of juvenile youth offenders lockup. He told me he had quote-unquote left, which implies to me that he just walked out of some kind of minimum security facility. The reason he gave me for quote-unquote leaving is that one of the guards or counselors or whatever they call their muscle men in this facility was putting him under very serious pressure to submit to certain perversions of the body, shall we say, in exchange for special treatment in the facility. So he breaks out or escapes or walks off from prison, and then he emails me and tells me all about it. Apparently, the name Edward Snowden means nothing to this kid. He sends an open and unencrypted email to an address which is one of the most utterly certain email addresses in North America to be intercepted, archived, and audited, i.e. read, on a regular basis. As much personal sympathy as I have for this boy, it's clear he's not exactly the sharpest knife in the drawer. I have no problems at all in believing his story about the guard wanting to be his big brother and protect him from the niggers in the can in exchange for bouts of bungholery in the shower or the interview room or whatever this filthy faggot does. Now, this is one reason why, if we must tolerate homosexuals at all in this society, and I don't believe we should at least prohibit them from jobs and positions which allow them access to children, and certainly ban them from any job where they are given any power and authority over the bodies of adolescent boys. Why the hell do you think the so-called gay rights movement has always concentrated specifically on removing any legal barriers to homos getting these positions, especially in places like the Boy Scouts and the schools and the prisons? It's how homosexuals reproduce by corrupting the young. Now, sorry, I know you guys think I'm obsessed with fags, and I admit I'm wandering like hell all over the map here, but I actually don't think this was an FBI hoax, and I suspect that this kid really was in that bad of a trouble that he had to break out of jail in order to keep from being sodomized by a prison guard. It's just such a typically American scenario in this year of our Lord 2014. Well, once the situation became clear to me, the first thing that I did was to turn over in my mind whether or not it was an attempt on the part of the dictator's servants to trick me into breaking the law by helping save a young white man from the razor wire and the KY jelly. Now, whether it was or not, there was only one thing I could possibly do, and I did it. I emailed this young man back in whatever public library or internet cafe he was hiding in, and I told him that neither I nor anyone else in the party could or would assist him in any way in breaking the law or evading the dictatorship, and that I was required by law to counsel him to turn himself in. He was not to contact me or anyone else in the party until his legal problems were permanently resolved, and I would delete any further emails from him unopened. Yes, that was disgraceful. One of the few genuinely disgraceful and despicable things I have ever done. It sickened me and made me deeply ashamed to do that. If you goat-dancing morons out there want to find something to shout and scream abuse at me over, then knock yourselves out over this incident, because I really did this young man a terrible wrong, which is unforgivable. I did so because this was a matter of pure survival, and I myself can do no good to the 14 words or the Northwest Republic by joining Edgar Steele and Bill White in prison if I can avoid it for a few more months or years. I should not allow one desperate and confused adolescent, however morally justified he was in demanding the help of all decent people against tyranny and sexual abuse, to give the enemy a handle on me in the Northwest Front to drag down what little we have so painstakingly built over the past 12 years by entangling me personally and by extension the rest of our small group with the system. The Northwest Front is one of the last remaining shreds of hope that the white race of human beings has to escape extinction. I simply could not allow this boy, who probably didn't fully understand the implications of what he was doing, to drag me down with him. And yes, I know how that sounds, and you are right, it is contemptible. But it is also necessary and my duty. Look, the chances are that the beast is going to get me sooner or later, if only through simply fabricating some kind of bogus case against me like they did with Edgar Steele and Bill White. Maybe this was that attempt, or the first attempt, or the third attempt, I don't know. The older I get, the more likely that becomes. They hate to have others see us growing old outside of a prison cell, because it gives the younger white boys ideas that if they're careful, they might actually make it. And we can't have young white boys getting ideas now, can we? But because this Northwest thing is indeed our last forlorn hope to preserve a 4,500-year-old heritage and civilization, I have a responsibility, not just to myself, but to all of you and to history, to stay free and to keep on writing and publishing and speaking for as long as I can before they find or fabricate some excuse to drag me away. So I turned my back on that boy. Without money, without ID, without friends or any support system at all, he has by now almost certainly been recaptured and returned to the prison, where he is now quite literally down in some basement or in some interrogation room, bent over a table with his trousers down around his ankles and America's dick up his ass. I apologize to Don from Salem. I know he doesn't like all the faggot references I make, and a lot of others don't either, but seriously, can you think of a better cameo of the reality that faces young white boys today in Obama's America? Folks, keep that image I just laid on you in your minds, because metaphorically and metaphysically speaking, that is the future that America holds for millions of young white people of both genders under the age of 30 now. They can't begin their lives properly under this foul third world dictatorship. There are no jobs, no infrastructure. They're still living with their parents, and they're going to have to spend the next 30 years delivering pizza and hauling scrap lumber on their backs for Labor Ready in order to pay down their $50,000 student loan debt for some useless degree in English literature or poli-sci. Well, I think a depressing first section like that deserves a depressing first music break. This is Ralph Stanley.
Oh, Dad. Oh, Dad. Won't you spare me over till another year? Well, what is this that I can't see with ice cold hands taking hold of me? Well, I am death, none can excel. I'll open the door to heaven or hell. Oh, death, someone would pray, could you wait to call me another day? The children prayed, the preacher preached, time and mercy is out of your reach. I'll fix your feet till you can't walk. I'll lock your jaws till you can't talk. I'll close your eyes so you can't see this very hour. Come and go with me. Death, I come to take the soul. Leave the body and leave it cold. To drop the flesh off of the frame, the earth and worm both have a claim. Oh, Death, oh, Death, won't you spare me over till another year? My mother came to my bed, placed a cold towel upon my head. My head is warm, my feet are cold. Death is moving upon my soul. Oh, Death, how you treating me? You closed my eyes so I can't see. Well, you're hurting my body. You make me cold. You run my life right out of my soul. Oh, Death, please consider my age. Please don't take me at this stage. My wealth is all at your command, if you will move your icy hands. Oh, the young, the rich or poor, all like me, you know. No wealth, no land, no silver, no gold. Nothing satisfies me but your soul. Oh, Death, oh, Death, won't you spare me over till another year? Won't you spare me over till another year? Won't you spare me over till another year?
Comrades, recently I was browsing and I was looking for something different, and every once in a while I enjoy finding a book that was written in Europe that reflects the continental nationalist movement. I found this manifesto that was originally published in Elements in 1999 and was recently republished by John Morgan in 2012. This is a manifesto that's talking about contemporary liberal democracy and how it has its seeds, according to this manifesto, in Christianity, because we see this notion of individual salvation, Salvation for All, which is egalitarian, and then a progressive or linear view of history. This pamphlet is really suggesting going back to an authentic pagan European religion, which has a circular view of history. It's talking about the contemporary marketplace and how there are people who don't make it within this marketplace, and the social reactions of socialism and Marxism, and also just this notion of welfare as prolonging this state of affairs, prolonging the state of liberal democracy. This manifesto sees these things as eventually dying a natural death. Now, one of the things that the French New Right is concerned about, and indeed this is a concern both in the States and in Europe, is all the unemployment that we see today, because we're moving into a time where we really don't need that many workers anymore. And the answer to this is a very French answer, because they talk about more workers working for fewer hours, and they would also like to disassociate work with income, because they want to come up with an economy that serves the people, and they want to get away from this frantic pace of modernity where we're constantly revamping, and the progression of technology is so fast that generations are getting more and more alienated from each other. Now, what the French New Right would like to do to help out this condition with all these immigrants coming in, they would like to cancel the third world debt, and they would also like to differentiate between the notion of citizenship versus nationality. The French New Right is anti-imperialistic because they're against the notion of positivism. They're against this notion of various stages of progress within societies and comparing various societies. Instead, they believe in something called differentialist anti-racism, which is a viewpoint that accepts the other as other and values intercultural diversity. Now, they also talk about this notion of federalism versus states' rights, and they talk about the Treaty of Westphalia at the end of the Thirty Years' War, and how the Treaty of Westphalia was a victory for federalism, but the Second Thirty Years' War, which they talk about as going on from 1914 to 1945, was a victory essentially for smaller states. And they're very concerned about this because now they feel that they have large states that are too big for little problems, and then these states are also too small for large problems. So they're really interested in this inter-European cooperation. They are for a common currency, and they're also for cooperation with Russia, which is something that we're seeing now in Europe. Russia is supporting a lot of these nationalist movements, and we also recently saw the election of Pen. They're also concerned with this notion of urban planning and the way that these days a job and a car are primarily your tools of socialization. And that if someone doesn't have a job or if they don't have a car, oftentimes society will view that person as lacking worth. And this manifesto is very much against that, which I think is really a ridiculous view of the person in society. And instead, they would like to return to a more collectivist society that, while having autonomy for various local areas, would also have very much shared goals, and would be united by a common founding myth within a self-conscious community. And they would really like a return to critical thought. because they're concerned that in contemporary liberal democracy, we really don't have debate so much as we have certain talking points that are repeated over and over. Really, that becomes a closed system that does not allow history to progress beyond what really is a block, kind of like a writer's block or a block of ideas. This is really a very concise pamphlet or manifesto or treatise, whatever you would like to call it. And it's very much like the fourth political theory, but I would say it's much more comprehensive. And I think it's right on the money with especially its concern with materialism and the frantic pace of life in modernity and how there has to be some moderation of this. Now, I'm not a total Luddite. I can see, for example, the value of a space program, for example, for many reasons. But I think that this treatise really makes some excellent points. I think it's really very inspiring and very correct in many ways. It also tells us very plainly that we should not feel a sense of guilt about endogamy because it's really not the same as racism. So all in all, I really found this treatise to be very worthwhile. I always enjoy reading these publications from Arctos Books, so I would very much recommend it.
I've been hearing Mr. Covington speak about the white character issue for some time. I was wanting a definition of what he meant, and I found a list of things I think address this issue. White folk virtues. Courage. My fear does not keep me from defending my folk, my family, or myself. I conquer my fear. Discipline. I control my mind, will, and emotions. I do, of my own accord, what needs to be done. Fidelity. I keep the vows I make, especially those to folk, family, and self. Honor. I keep pure the name and honor of my folk, family, and self. Hospitality. For folk and family, I willingly share my food, hearth, and shelter. Industriousness. I perform my tasks with joy and honor, holding nothing back. Perseverance, I continue until I've met my obligations and my goals. Self-reliance, I support my folk, my family, and myself. I depend only on myself. I strengthen the independence of the folk and family. Truth, I search for and embrace the truth. When speaking the truth may harm my folk or family, I keep silent. Live with courage and honor, comrades.
I'm sensitive to the criticism that I'm always telling people what they shouldn't do. Like, you shouldn't email me telling me all about how you just escaped from prison and you're a fugitive from justice, and could I please help you out? And some of you complain that we never explain to people what they should do. So, I tell you what, by way of spaced repetition, I will once again explain to all of you young folks out there exactly what you should do if you one day want to live in the world depicted in my Northwest novels. And yes, that can happen. The game plan is very simple. Parts of it are hard, yes, but not overwhelmingly so. Anybody can do it if you possess just a fraction of the attention span and the willpower that used to be part and parcel of the white character. Now let me begin by stating a few unpalatable truths. My novels are fiction. They describe a world which will probably exist in some form or other at some point in the future, quite possibly nearer in the future than any of us realize, but which does not exist now. Right now, when you come to the Northwest, you will find many of the same problems that you left behind. I'm not going to try and hide that. It's not our homeland yet. That's why you are coming here, to make it so. Yes, you're going to see niggers and Mexicans here, just far fewer of them than you would anywhere else. You will find politically correct liberal bullshit here, especially in Seattle and Portland. That's what you're coming here to change. There is no Weimar-style revolution going on here, more's the pity. We are starting very largely from scratch, doing the kind of basic infrastructure stuff that we should have started 50 years ago, and for that I deeply apologize. But it is what it is. When you arrive here in the homeland, you will need three essential things. You will need a job. You will need a functioning automobile. And you will need a place to live. We can help you obtain these things on your own by acting as your contact on the ground here in the homeland and running errands for you before you arrive. One of the best things that a woman comrade did for me before I migrated was to rent a storage space and stash my stuff when I shipped it to her. We cannot give things to you. This means that you are going to have to bring a functioning automobile with you, and you're going to have to bring enough money in your kick to get you settled in. Now, there are all kinds of variations on everyone's migration story. Each migration is different. We've had guys roll up at the local bus station in a Greyhound, and we've had families arrive more or less in convoys of cars and trucks. We have had guys arrive at SeaTac or Portland or Boise airports with nothing but a couple of suitcases, but enough resources and assets to just buy everything here from scratch. But let's assume that you're a t-shirt youth, and you're sitting there in mom's basement listening to this flat broke, and you decide you've got the right stuff and it's time to start living the life instead of playing a computer game. Let me tell you how you should do it, how this kid who emailed me last week should have done it. Now, the first thing you need to do is to obtain a job where you are. I understand that this is, in many respects, the hardest part of all, because some of you aren't living in some very economically salubrious places. All I can say is that it has to be done somehow. The centerpiece, the key to migration, is to save money until you have at least a few thousand dollars in your kick. Now, realistically, if you're a t-shirt youth, you're looking at about $8 an hour or whatever the minimum wage is in your state, and because of Obamacare, you probably won't be able to get anything over 29.5 hours. What you will probably have to do is what white working class people and families have done for many years now, trying to make it in a capitalist economy where the employers are doing whatever they can to avoid paying benefits. Now, that practice actually goes way back beyond Obamacare. I remember it was customary in places like Texarkana and Charleston and Centralia for everybody to have at least two jobs. And some families with children old enough to work would have four or five part-time jobs per family. And once you obtain that job or jobs, you keep it. You report to work on time and sober. And you do what you are told. And you don't dick off like you did in school. You don't quarrel with your co-workers and supervisors and try to prove how you know better about everything, because you don't. You don't walk off the job in a huff after 2 weeks because your boss is a nappy-headed, bubble-lipped nigger who insults and harasses you. You do what ordinary white people do because they have to. You bow your head and you bend your knee because you have to have that paycheck. You must have it to come home and begin fighting back where the hell you're supposed to be. Now, these bozos that you work for have money. You need it, so you eat whatever excremental confections they set before you so that you can collect that paycheck every week and sock away every penny of it you can. You will not spend your money on beer. You will not spend your money on cigarettes. And yes, I know I smoke a pipe, but I'm already here where I'm supposed to be, and I'm not saving for migration. Do as I say, not as I do, because I've made enough mistakes to know where I went wrong, and I'm willing to guide you and show you if you'll just listen. Oh, and if you smoke dope, stop it. You don't want to get entangled with the legal system where you are in a way that forces you to hang around while you mess with court dates and stuff. It's legal here in Washington now, but if you're smart, you won't start again when you get here. I really can't see us making a revolution out of a bunch of potheads. Sorry, where was I? Oh, yeah. Disconnect your cable TV. You don't need to be spending $100 a month to watch liberal crap. Begin the process of stripping down your place, packing and shipping stuff, whatever needs to be done, slowly and gradually, so that you don't have to do it all at once and it doesn't seem like such a monumental task. And like I said, we can help you out when you actually start the move. Now, it works like this. You get up in the morning, you shower and wash your stinky ass, you go to work and shovel whatever dreck they tell you to shovel, hopefully for 8 hours. You come home, You have a can of Campbell's soup or something similar, which you heat in a saucepan because you have already sold or given away your microwave as an unneeded luxury. You read a book for a while, and then you go to bed and do it all over again the next day. You do this for about a year, maybe a little longer. You do not spend one single penny that you don't have to. And one day, you will wake up and you got $3,000 or $4,000 in your pocket. Your car is freshly serviced and tuned for a long trip. Your flea bag apartment is emptied out and you're dropping off the keys. And then the open road stretches out before you. It will be time for you to finally do your duty to your race and civilization. Get in that car, turn the ignition, and hit the road.
Westward from the Davis Strait, 'twas there 'twas said to lie, the sea route to the Orient, for which so many died. Seeking gold and glory, leaving weather broken bones, and a long forgotten lonely care. For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage. Three centuries thereafter, I take passage overland in the footsteps of brave Kelso, where his sea of flowers began. Watching cities rise before me, then behind me sink again. This tardiest explorer driving hard across the plain. For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one more line through a land so wide and savage, and make the Northwest behind the wheel, the mileage clicking west. I think upon Mackenzie, David Thompson, and the rest, who cracked the mountain ramparts and did show a path for me to race the roaring Fraser. For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one more line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage. So different from the first men through this way. Like them, I left a settled life. I threw it all away to seek a Northwest Passage at the call of many men, to find their but the road back. Thank you. take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing a waterline through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage for the sea.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner again. My prior Real Politics talk ended with two rhetorical questions about white nationalist leadership and our reaction to it. Weeks ago, I hinted at where I'm going next, and while I would very much like to get there, I have a certain plan in mind, and I'm forcing myself to stick to it. Next time, I'm going to do something interesting with communism. But today, I really need to expand on the concept of leadership in the white nationalist community. To be completely honest, I'm not very learned on this subject, so I'm going to have to keep it fairly generic. I'm not the person to go asking about this topic, but I do have a few general observations. Further, it's understood by just about everyone that the best decisions and procedures are very difficult to come by. Effective people and groups tend to get by if they simply avoid bad choices and behavior. Sadly, the white nationalist movement hasn't even attempted to get that far, as I detailed in Real Politics 6. Most, but by no means all, of this is due to the inability to choose the correct course of action, or even an objective at all. However, this creates the problem of accepting by default anyone and everyone who says they're a white nationalist, or even merely pro-white, as someone who should be held up for potential leadership. I'm glad this particular talk was delayed a week, because it gave me the opportunity to observe and make a minor contribution to a conversation on Facebook, where someone called out a well-known white nationalist who is responsible for a very long series of blatant and egregious infractions against the movement as a whole over a period of many decades. I've seen this conversation play out dozens of times, and to be honest, it never really gets anywhere. Radio Free Northwest has taken to calling this phenomenon the first taboo. Anytime the party attempts to address this topic in a concrete way, we're forced into dredging up actual examples, and this always sets people off. After Real Politics 6, which discussed the underlying problem behind white genocide, you have nearly everything you need to tell if someone is a decent white nationalist or not, so I don't feel the need to go there again, especially in a way which would cause the space madness to set in. Like I said, I'm not at all an expert on leadership, but the trend I'm remarking on today is something I myself have experienced on numerous occasions. I'll take this opportunity to remind you all that the Northwest Front doesn't have a set hierarchy or even a tangible organization. This isn't the time to go into why, but the fact itself is very important to my point. It's true I've been identified as the Seattle unit guy, but that's largely a matter of circumstance and necessity. I'm perfectly happy to hold the post, but as things stand, it's nothing more than titular. People possessing very strange and entirely uninformed assumptions about my position, both with the Northwest Front and as part of white nationalism, regularly contact the party about my standing, or lack thereof. I half suspect quite a few of these inquiries are simply an attempt at sleuthing out the structure of the organization. It doesn't seem to matter how many times Harold and I insist otherwise, but there isn't one. At all. And if there's no organization, I can't hold a position in it. Despite this, I'm frequently identified as Harold's sidekick, number two, right-hand man, and all sorts of other things. Quite some time ago, I gave an introduction to the NF for those unfamiliar with the contact process and the expectations we have of those interested in the Northwest Imperative. This introduction, originally in the form of an RFN segment, was later used to create a video by one of our comrades. This video hit a well-known white nationalist news blog which proceeded to identify me as one of the Northwest Front's top officials. Their words. As always, I'm quite happy someone made the choice to help publicize party materials, but this was well before my not-quite status in the party had been made public. And further, if I'm a top official, where are the middle officials? What I'm getting at is an incredibly odd propensity in white nationalism to hold up anyone and everyone as a leader or potential leader once they've indicated they might share a portion of our racial and political beliefs. One Puget area comrade asked that if Harold and I are said to be leaders, then why is it very few of you seem to have any interest whatsoever in following our lead? In all honesty, this is what the matter boils down to, but once again, reality doesn't seem to factor into the white nationalist political scene. Very recently, when this topic came up at another of our local meetings, another comrade made the point that I have a certain amount of moral authority despite our lack of formal organization. While very true, this doesn't invalidate my remarks on the situation as a whole. So, what gives? Well, let's pull up a couple basic concepts like human nature and the stages of learning. A human nature being what it is, the vast majority of us are very interested in getting other people to do things we don't want to. More importantly, someone who is competent in the field of human nature will most definitely understand when it expresses itself. I've made frequent reference to various online conversations I'm invited to participate in. Without fail, the subject of who should lead white nationalism comes up, and when it does, I always make popcorn in preparation. The sorts of people put forward for leadership candidates are always laughable. There are absolutely no criteria used other than an online presence and perhaps a few blog posts, all of which are terrible. When I chime in with the suggestion that we should be able to identify the proposed plans of these leaders, and their plans ought to actually stop white genocide, I'm usually immediately ejected. I won't list specific names, even if I do give certain details which might or might not identify who I'm speaking of. Were I to actually tell you who I have in mind when I give examples, my actual point would be lost because I would make room for the first taboo to rear its ugly head and send the entire movement into another frenzy. Remember why I'm doing these talks. White nationalists absolutely refuse to make mature, rational, and responsible political choices and strategic decisions. Granted, most of you aren't going to change that, but I have to hope there are at least a few of you out there interested in actually stopping white genocide. Last time I was on Radio Free Northwest, I laid out exactly what it would take to implement the 14 words. More precisely, I reiterated the underlying problem we need to solve. If you don't quite get it yet, go back and re-listen until you do. I ended the segment by asking why we, as white nationalists, put up with so-called leaders who have absolutely no intention of participating in the one plan which could actually prevent the extinction of our race. The behavior exhibited, however, is far more destructive than mere refusal to do the right thing. One of the more peculiar, though seemingly short-lived examples, is the author of a white nationalist blog with quite a few explicit and perverse entries. One of these entries sought to teach people about what whites should and shouldn't do with their various bodily fluids. That's classy stuff. It's so classy that several people used it as proof of his leadership status. Yeah. Another leader I saw promoted quite regularly by some very questionable folks in their own right is yet another one of these guys trying to create their own religion. Okay, it's not like other white nationalists haven't tried that one before, but the fellow in question made every attempt possible to mimic every other effort in white nationalism, including the Northwest Imperative. His strategy seemed to be try a little bit of everything and see what sticks in an effort to further his own attention whoring. Yet another wannabe leader placed on his Facebook page pictures of women he took at the mall with his cell phone. Of their asses, without them knowing. He was pretty proud of this, too, even when others confronted him about it. Anyone reaching adulthood, without having figured out this isn't remotely acceptable, doesn't belong anywhere near white nationalism. In all likelihood, this guy is probably just looking for attention he's not going to get anywhere else. But that's besides the point. Why would he expect to be taken seriously at all? Well, this goes back to the cause of the conversation I mentioned at the opening of this segment. The white nationalist movement has a long history of destructive, dishonest, perverted, and non-white leadership, and someone who bothered to pay attention to any of this would fully expect freaks and mediocrities to fit right in. They're not exactly wrong, either. There are a few patterns which emerge when the first taboo is breached, and under cursory scrutiny, they all back up my claim that these so-called leaders are anything but. Firstly, whenever anyone is a popular white nationalist leader, they're universally considered to be a good man, in quotes. I'm not quite sure what all this means since these good men, in quotes, either stole from their supporters, took checks from the federal government, or otherwise participated in activity which is either outright immoral or detrimental to actually saving our race. Secondly, these people are always said to have done more for the movement than anyone attacking them. Also in quotes. Those of you who have internalized the basics of real politics I keep harping on will see right through this stupid, stupid lie. If these so-called leaders have done anything at all for the movement, then white nationalism would have gotten somewhere. I can hear some of you yelling at your computers, iPods, or whatever that I'm just being mean for the sake of being mean, but I'm not. It's laughable to claim anyone has done anything of lasting value that someone with time on their hands and a few old books on racial subjects couldn't do for themselves. Thirdly, a less common but still predictable objection to a particular leader being critically examined is that white unity is hurt when we have these discussions. White unity isn't really a thing, and even if it were, it would be hurt a lot more by racial extinction, which is the only possible outcome of listening to these people. They endorse any and every option, but the one which has any possibility of actually saving our folk. Exactly why do you want unity with them anyway? If someone actively tells their audience, listeners, or readers not to obey the Northwest Imperative, then they shouldn't be your comrade, since they're actually on the wrong side. Rush Limbaugh regularly mocks liberals and Democrats for caring about intentions without noticing the results. I could sum up my point today in exactly the same way. Just because someone says they're a white nationalist, or merely pro-white in public, doesn't mean they deserve any attention. Further, criticizing them, especially when they've got no damn clue about actually stopping white genocide via the Butler Plan, isn't mean, wrong, or divisive. Whatever you happen to think of these people, remember that their results add up to exactly nothing. Their intentions are obviously of no effect, and you're just as bad as the godforsaken Democrats if you think they deserve our respect. The only reason we have to have this conversation is that if there are no faux leaders hanging around, some of you might feel compelled to do something yourselves. And that's just no fun. Hail victory, comrades.
Let's see, we're, what, 52 minutes in now? Yeah, I guess it's time for third music break. Now, what have I not played recently? I guess it's time to give you Skinhead Rockers another tune or two. This is No Remorse, and I believe the cut's called Son of Odin.
Self-fulfilled, hold its wrath. A brave new world, max cowards tremble, men stand tall. The strong survive, the weak they fall. Time has come, the giants are men. With a smash of his hammer, nothing can contend. Son of Odin, God of War.
The other night, a local comrade stopped by, and we were sitting in my hovel batting the breeze, like us old racist white guys seem to spend so much of our time doing, and the subject came up of a longtime conservative newspaper and internet columnist named Fred Reed, whom some of you may know from having read his column, Fred on Everything. Now, the main topic of discussion was a malpractice suit that Fred now has going against an idiot doctor who blinded him by accident and through incompetence. No word on the race of that doctor, although I think we can guess, since most of the doctors that poor white people have access to are now third worlders who got their medical degrees at the University of Rangoon or wherever. Now, I mentioned that I'd read Fred's material in the past, and I thought he was one of the best of the paleoconservative columnists, including a refreshing willingness to talk sense about Israel. But as I recalled, he would occasionally throw comments into his writing about how Obama was like Hitler, which is utterly absurd, and how the present regime's surveillance and legal tactics were like the Gestapo, silly crap like that. Fred was born in 1945. And so he isn't old enough to remember World War II, but he grew up with the official version of history, so he can't just dump the journalistic bad habits that he picked up during his long career. I suspect he actually knows better. But then this friend and I started talking about how long it takes certain white people to learn wisdom and to truly understand the nature of the world we live in and how it works and how that process takes place. Now, if we can figure out the key elements in that awakening, then maybe we can find some way to make it take place in people a little earlier than age 44 or 45, which seems to be the case now. Now, of course, there's a lot of complex factors involved in such a process, but I told him that in my mind, there are three key ideas, three things that a white man or woman must come to understand, and once he or she wraps her mind around those three things, then all else follows. Without understanding these three crucial concepts, then the person may be 95% right on race and the economy and Obama and everything else. And Jared Taylor comes to mind. But they'll still toddle off this mortal coil as nothing but a fairly sharp conservative, and they will be incapable of taking part in any bona fide solution to the problem. These three things are what everyone has to know in order to cease being part of the problem and become part of the solution. Now, the first thing that white people have to come to understand is that we fought on the wrong side during World War II. They have to come to recognize that Hitler was right, and that everything they have been told about him and about the Third Reich is a politically motivated lie. The second thing that white people have to somehow come to wrap their minds around is the Jewish question. Not the details of it. You can spend a lifetime studying the kikes in detail, and some of us do. But we have to learn and accept the fact that there is a Jewish question at all. These creatures are not cute, harmless little fiddlers on the roof dancing around like clowns wearing funny blue beanies. They are a world problem and a deadly threat to humanity. The third thing that white people have to come to grips with is a kind of a synthesis of the first two essential concepts. The fact that the Holocaust, as advertised, is a massive hoax and never happened in any form remotely resembling the official version. Yes, World War II was bloody beyond belief. Millions of people got killed, and some of them were Jews. Nobody denies that. But the whole Auschwitz gas chamber soap and lampshade shtick is a deliberate hoax engineered to extort money from the white nations of Europe and to justify the subsequent atrocities committed by the bandit state of Israel. Now that's it. Three simple ideas. Once you can get these three ideas into someone's brain and get them internalized, that person is ours for life. They can never completely disconnect or uninstall that knowledge. It will always be there. They can never go back to the herd, and I think they know it, which is why so many white people resist these ideas like hell and will get really upset and occasionally violent when you try to convince them. Now, something in white people's subconscious mind tells them that once they even so much as consider any of these three ideas, there's no going back. They will have broken the chain that keeps them anchored to the comfortable herd. Now they're cut off from the herd forever. And in the 21st century, that terrifies white people. Ironically, it's kind of a 180-degree reverse of the old pioneer instinct that we used to have 8 or 9 generations ago. In those days, we left the herd and started on the long march west to find new lands and new lives. That's day we huddle together in a trembling mass. We hoard what we have desperately lest lawyers or the government come to try and take it, be it our money or our jobs or our toys or our mental and historical illusions. I get people who come to me asking how to go about converting others to our point of view. Well, that's how. Those are the three crucial weaknesses in Joe Sixpack's social conditioning. Slide into his mushy brain and reverse the polarity on those three things, and we have a new comrade. Well, our time is up. Godot still hasn't arrived, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Underban. Freedom.